Our world is magical. Games are magical. Open your eyes and prepare to discover how magic and games intersect.
Merry meet and welcome to Covenstead, a podcast about gaming and magic.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Covenstead podcast, where we talk about gaming and magic. I'm Danny. And with me is my co-host, co-conspirator, I don't know, whatever, titles, Todd.
I think we're at the part where I could be called a coven mate.
Coven mate?
I don't know. I think coven mate kind of works under the circumstances.
Yeah. We're here. We're doing this.
Yeah.
And all of that. Yes. So my coven mate, Todd. Say hello, Todd. Say hello to everybody.
Hello, Todd. I mean, hello, Danny. There we go. I've been watching some history of comedy documentary, and so the old George and Gracie bits of like, say goodnight, Gracie, you know, has been running in my head lately.
Yes.
So, nice. Yeah. Now, before we get to our topic for today, let's give everybody some little updates because we ran a Kickstarter a little over a month ago. And it funded. And so that means that things have been happening these last couple of weeks that we want to brag about. So I guess there's two things that we can break this into. There's our social media updates, and then there's an Ironbound update. So Danny, would you like to give the social media update?
That we have now a Discord and a Facebook. That people can come and join us and talk with us and let us know what you think. The Discord is, we're getting started. We have people in there talking and it's good. And our Facebook group is there also, so you can come and talk to us and post things to us and all of that. And yeah, so feel free. We're going to post those on our own social media, but for those who would like to, the group is called Covenstead on Facebook. You'll be able to see the lovely logo that you see every time you watch one of our podcasts, that one that Todd created that I love so much. And the Covenstead is also the name of our Discord. It's called the Covenstead as well.
Yeah. And we'll have links to those in every single episode moving forward. And you know what? Maybe I'll go and I'll update the past episodes as well. But we'll have the links in the actual show notes for every single episode moving forward and going backwards. We're going to do a little time traveling. That's how this is going to work.
Okay. That sounds good.
Cool.
So come and join
us. Yeah, so there's that. So yeah, so everyone... Yes, everyone has a way now that they can, you know, reach out and actually ask us questions, become a part of this. We've already got some of our backers have had some of the early access to it. They're helping us kind of test and work out the kinks. And we've already made a few changes and added a couple extra channels on there and stuff like this. So it's really good. The Facebook group over the weekend actually just hit 50 people. That was really cool to see.
Nice.
Mostly because a lot of stuff I do never attracts 50 people in a Facebook group. So this is my most successful attempt yet. This is great.
It's our Wonder Twin powers. That's what it is. Our Wonder Twin powers.
Ah, there we go. That's right. Our social media powers combine form of Twitter. Oh, no, we're not doing Twitter, by the way. Yeah, that's not going to happen. but the other thing that happened with the Kickstarter is we had quite a few people who expressed a lot of interest in actually helping playtest Ironbound. And so one of the things that we have spent the last month or so on is getting everything done and ready. And in fact, as we record this, I'm literally just waiting to actually pull the trigger on updating our backers with the links to everything. So if that's something that you're interested in, let us know, especially too, you know. Join this Facebook group that we just happened to mention. Come on and pop into our Discord. And the material that we have 110 pages worth of stuff, which is...
Wait, what? Really?
It's 110 pages. Yeah, all told with everything. Well, it's because we have the creation ritual included, we wanted to make sure that that was as detailed as possible. So I thought about cutting it out, but at the same time, too, it's really good, and it's,
if we do say so ourselves.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and there's like a third of it is Danny's material, which is all the setting stuff that's in the Book of Iron. And then the other third of it is the rules themselves and character creation that's in the Book of Resistance. And then there is an introductory adventure, which is our remake of So Mote It Be, which is how an Ironbound Coven can be formed within this particular region. It's a redone version of the original one that we had for the PIP system. Way more expanded, stretched out. It uses a lot of the stuff that I've been incorporating into my personal playtests of the game and everything. So yeah, all told, it's 110 pages. It also comes with 7 pre-generated characters, all of them from playtesters in the 2 games that I had been running over the last couple years. So that's really cool. And so there's a shit ton of stuff for you to get started on to, and this is like a sampling of the kind of thing that we want to do. So that's done and available. And these are all things that are all thanks to our Kickstarter backers. And it's been really great since we did it. We've pushed over 100 downloads, which is really good for an up and starting podcast, as I understand it. So this is great. Like, it's really been a nice ego boost, and especially for me with, a few of my other creative projects have literally just like, popped like a balloon, or more so kind of like when you untie the bottom of the balloon and then it just goes So this has been really nice to see that this one is taking off in still kind of humble origins. It's, it's really cool to see. And the people who are getting behind our show really seem to be in favor. They really like the premise of what we're doing. The interview we did with Liz and Steffi was also really super cool. We're already starting to talk to people, to some other people to try and line us some other interviews about other Witch and Wiccan themed games that are out there at the moment. So there's a lot that I think 2023 is definitely going to be like an upgrade time for this show. And I'm really looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So today we're going to talk about roles, I guess. Is that how we want to put it? Like game masters and players and group dynamics? Is that how we're phrasing it?
Yeah, like player roles, like R-O-L-E, which we just should clarify, actually. So, yeah, the whole idea of, like, the different roles and everything that people take at the table, so to speak, whether or not it's virtual, physical, gathered around a blanket in a park or something like that. Mm. Because there's a lot of misconception, I find personally, like when our generation started playing, the whole idea is that all games lived and died off of the game master skills, the GM skills, or the dungeon master skills, the keeper, the judge, whichever title was associated with whichever game. Mm-hmm. And I know both of us don't necessarily believe that. There's a lot more cooperative effort and everything that's involved. But yeah, I thought it was really interesting to talk about this from a gaming standpoint. Because it's also one of those things where, just like with any group, like in a coven of witches, everyone's kind of got their own role to play, their own thing that they offer that makes that group unique, where you can't tell the same story with a different group because you don't have the same dynamics in play and everything like that. So yeah, that's what I thought would be interesting. It's been on my mind a lot lately, and I thought it'd be interesting.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like you were saying, both in a coven and in a gaming group, you have, everybody brings their unique spark, their unique thoughts, their unique abilities, their unique strengths and unique weaknesses. And whether you're at the gaming table or in a coven, using everybody's unique traits and abilities, in in a way where everybody can get together and get something out of it is awesome. I mean, and thus you have no two gaming groups who are alike and no two covens that are alike. Everybody does things differently. And if somebody leaves and somebody else comes in, the dynamics change. That's just how it is, because now you have somebody coming in who is different than the person who left, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So let me ask you something, because this is something that to me is, you know, how most people will, when you say it's like, oh, I like to play role-playing games, most people say like, oh, what games do you play? Or what game got you started and everything like that? The question I often like to ask first is, if a new game were to suddenly start up, would you want to be the GM, the game master, or game moderator, which is the term I prefer to use when it comes to GM? Would you prefer to be the GM or a player? Like, right off the bat, you've got 5 seconds to make a decision before the coin is flipped in the air and lands in someone's hand. Which one would you go for?
Play. Play. Yeah. And get me wrong. I love game mastering, but you only gave me 5 seconds to decide. So, you know, because typical me, my answer would have been along, well, you know, it depends. Is this person starting the game because they want a game master for the first time? Or are we starting this game because we have new players who want to try role playing? In that case, I would probably want a game master since I have experience to guide them through it. Or if somebody wanted to, you know, be game master and try it for the first time, then I would play and use my skills to kind of help support them in learning how to run a game. However, if I just have to make a decision off the top, and all things being equal, like we all have the same experience, we all can run games and everything, I'd probably play. Because I guess in the end, I mean, I like characters, I like people. And I always have a good time trying to figure out somebody new to play and somebody new to be, and focusing on that and putting all my energy into this one character. Whereas when you GM, you know, you're everybody. So everybody else. And and man, you know, it's hard. It's thinking on your feet. You know, of course they're going to want to talk to the shopkeeper who you have no idea did not exist before 2 seconds ago when they wanted to walk into the store. So now you gotta have them walk in. They want to talk to the shopkeeper. Now you have to find something interesting about the shopkeeper to make them feel three-dimensional. And then they like the shopkeeper, they get involved in it, and it just snowballs. Anyway, and that's hard. And I do get attached to NPCs sometimes, but because I'm game mastering, I don't get attached to them, because that's not their purpose. Their purpose is not for me to get attached to them. Their purpose is to help facilitate the story my players are trying to tell with their characters. And so I can't afford to be precious about them, right? I can't afford to, like, not let them be embarrassed, or to not let them die, or not let them be awful people, you know, because I just can't do that. So I guess given the choice, I'd rather play, because then every single energy that I'm using that if I'm running a game, I would normally be putting into NPCs and setting and the story and the arcs that are going on and managing all of that, I can just focus and make this one character really, really deep, you know? And it's all I have to worry about is this one character and how they're reacting to the things that are going on, giving their backstory. Now, I don't want that to mean, you know, that I don't like game mastering. Game mastering has a lot of rewards to it as well. I mean, you know, you get the reward of watching them react to your story. You get the reward of watching the characters grow and all of that, and good moments and everything. But hey, you put me on the spot. So there we go.
That I did. That is true. That is true.
What about you?
Oh, I game master in a heartbeat. Like 9 times out of 10, even 99 out of 100, I would totally be the GM in it. because I like that frantic pace, that whole idea. For me, GMing really is parallel to improving in that, and I'm talking about what I call true improv. So when I first started doing improv in high school, we were not aware that there is a formality to the process where, you know, we went to a competition. There were four or five of us, and it was just like we had no preparation whatsoever. We brought no props. We had no concept of what we were going to do for each sketch because we practiced everything as we used random cards, created a scene, and then we went from there. And sometimes we brought in people to watch and they came up with stuff and then we just made it up from there. But these other teams had concepts in mind. It's just like, you know, so for this, for our third game, we're going to be doing this. We're going to use the supermarket one. And the only thing we need to change is what the person is buying and what they're wearing when they go. And everything else is something they've done time and time again. Mm. We basically did it where we made up things completely on the fly in the 30 seconds that they gave us to prepare. And so for me, that's what I get with GMing. You know, like, and everything fits within a certain context. You've got the game itself that's holding everything together. You have willing participants who are your other players who are there for the same reason as you, but just from the other side of the table. I just love that idea of creating everything as I go, especially because anytime I prepare something, it's never able to go off exactly as I plan, which is why I find adventure writing so hard to do. Because, yeah, I can't, you know, it's almost kind of like when you write an adventure, you're trying to give assurances to the other GM who will then be reading it to say, is like, don't worry, this is exactly how it's going to go down, or it's going to go down to a pretty reasonable simile. I already know my own group wasn't, in fact, neither of the groups that I've run So Mo to Be with in our current version of Ironbound have done anything close to the ending that's actually written in the adventure. They went a completely different direction, and it ended up being so incredibly cool because it got me to think about other ways to think of certain stuff, you know, and that's what I like. For me, it feels like being the GM is like being a player times five. But I never thought about it before in that sense of, you're right, you don't really get a chance to get in depth with these NPCs. Like, if you're playing your character, you've just assigned the one character, and that's who you are, and you can get attached to them and feel a sense of development of who they actually are as a person. That, let's say, for example, if you wanted to do, like, a crying scene where it's just like, my character gets very emotional, it's very difficult to do that as a GM because you've just been bullet pointing that NPC and just trying to establish, like, you normally, you have a voice for them or mannerisms, a way that you can kind of take on that personality very quickly without going into a lot of detail. Whereas when it's your player character, you get that sense of, like, I had a character when I was a teenager. His whole job was he was supposed to betray the party. And I had built him. I had a sense of honor about him. He was a soldier, but he was dying. And so he wanted to go out in a blaze of glory. This is the way he could serve as king. But because it took months and months of me playing this person, when it got to the point where the people he was supposed to betray actually saved his life and cured him, there was no way, I knew there was no way my character could still betray them. And that was because I'd spent months playing him. If I was an NPC, I could easily just, like, you know, like, yeah, maybe he could, but I'm just going with it because this is what I want to do. You know, I'm more action focused with my NPCs than I am personally invested with a PC. And I've never thought about that before. That's an interesting point. But yeah, I would take GMing anytime because I get that adrenaline rush with GMing.
I call it fear. No, just kidding.
Sure. I want to throw up in a bucket before every game because it's just like, oh, I don't know how this is going to go. But that's to me, that's also that same kind of thrill. Like, you're an actress. You've had those moments where you're about to go out and perform, you know, and that sense of anxiety and everything. But then when it's said and done and it works and it goes well, the euphoria that you get afterwards, you know.
Oh, yeah, And what that is experience, right? You know, I get nervous before each performance that I've done, you know, on stage. And I also get nervous before games, you know, because I want everybody to have a good time. I want, you know, if I'm playing a game, I want the players to have a good time. I want them to have fun. And if I'm on stage, I want, you know, the audience to be entertained. And so both times you get this anxiety beforehand. Like, oh my God, what if everything goes wrong? What if I step on stage and go to open my mouth and nothing comes out? Which has happened to me. And it has. Or in gaming where you're like, what if everything goes to pot? Which it has, you know? And the thing is, you know it's happened before. You're worried about it happening. But then what I find happens is once I step on stage or once I start playing, all of, like, for lack of a better term, the muscle memory that I've cultivated over years of doing stage and years of playing games kicks in, right? The rehearsal and all of that kind of takes you and kind of carries you through until you're at the end and realize that nothing happened and it was fine. You know, you built a structure underneath so that here's what I've watched a lot of acting coaches, and here's something that might help GMs too. GMs could do a lot worse than looking at acting coaches and lessons and things like that, because they have a lot of lessons for that you can take to the table. And one of them is that when you go into auditions, you don't want to show your work. You don't want to show that you're acting, right? You want to show what you have done, and you have to trust that your education and your training and your experience is going to support you so that you can let go and be creative. And that's the same way with gaming. You know, you prep and, you know, you think about what's going to happen. You make a few notes, knowing, as we like to put it at our table, that no plan survives contact with the enemy. as mm-hmm. a general wants to put it, right? So I can plan out, but I know it's not going to go the way I'm thinking it will. But, you know, you prep and you think about it and you build a structure underneath you and the times you've had to improv. And so you have all that supporting you when you step to the table or you step on stage. And then you can kind of just trust that your preparation will support you and that your experience will support you so that your creativity can shine through and your artistry can shine through.
Nice. Yeah, it's interesting. I've never thought about it before in the sense of, like, your approach to it is much more, to me, sounds kind of more like, you know, I like playing because it's very similar to your experience as an actress working with a script. You have very specific dialogue that you can say that you can maybe fumble your way through in case it suddenly slips. But in general, you know what's supposed to be coming across, because next is going to be this scene. You know, you're helping the audience experience something, and you've had time to kind of work on it and understand where you want to come at it from. You know, it's like, oh, in the audition, you tried it where you were shrieking at high notes, but then later auditions, you found, like, you know, using like a deeper rumbling voice worked really well to sell this moment, that kind of stuff. I've never really thought about it before as looking at being a player as being an actor, where it's just like, my job is to nail this one character and to really make them stand out in this moment. I think the reason why that's so hard for me to do, I think, is because, I don't know. I think I worry about the fact that I'm not without that adrenaline rush. Like, when I GM, I like to think of myself as a more civilized Robin Williams, so to speak. You know, in a sense where it's like, I know I got to keep going and create at a frenetic pace. And if all of a sudden everything completely changes, I got to pick up on that. I got to roll with it. I've also got to keep my audience in check in case someone's getting a little rowdy, you know, that kind of thing. But at the same time, too, I'm not expected to be running around on stage and, you know, like and going really wild and making fart jokes and all this other kind of stuff. So I don't know. Maybe it's because without that adrenaline rush that I'm getting as I go, I think I'm just kind of concerned that I'm going to get bored and listless. And when that happens, I become jokey. You know, like it, the reason why I don't play as often, I feel, is very similar why I'm terrible to be an attendee at a seminar. Unless that seminar is damn captivating, I'm going to start cracking jokes because I'm bored. And that's like it's a terrible reflex. I had to attend a seminar because I'm training to become a part-time school bus driver to help out in my area and stuff like this. And I had to attend a seminar that was about handling confrontations with students and everything else like this. And it was 3 hours. It did not need to be 3 hours, personally speaking. 45 minutes would have been fine. So for the other 2 hours and 15 minutes, I'm really suppressing myself and just be like, no, don't turn around and make this kind, you know, because that's what I do when I get bored. And that, as a participant in a game, is what we call a dick move. That's yes. Just not fair to the GM and the other players to be the jokester at the table, you know. Like the last couple of characters that I did play as a player, I specifically made a point of playing them up as being the comedy relief of the group. I specifically chose characters so that if that was the case, it was supposed to be expected of my character. Which is why I played bards more than anything recently, because just like, oh, well, then that's the kind of person that they get. It's more believable for the bard to be a jokester than the barbarian to be a jokester.
Right.
So, yeah. But yeah, maybe I do need to start thinking about it more as like an acting opportunity.
I mean, that's just me. I mean, that's, you know, everybody brings their own. I mean, if it might help to think about that. I mean, I just, that's how I tend to think of it. I mean, it's why I like writing. It's why I like gaming. It's why I like acting. Because all of that is just characters. It's just people and a story on stage or on the page or at the table. That's really what it comes down to for me. I mean, that's what we kind of do this stuff for, in my opinion, at least for me. You know, I want these people to grow. I want to hear their story. I want to be immersed in it. And you know, and knowing like you do how, you know, and that's part of, I guess, since we're talking about roles, part of being able to figure out where you fit in is knowing yourself too, and knowing where your strengths are and where your weaknesses are and how you react to certain things. And sometimes, you know, the table or the stage is a great place to get out of your comfort zone. You know, try to build up on some of those weaknesses. I have played characters that are the complete opposite of me. Or at least I feel like. I mean, they all come from somewhere. So just the very little bitty parts, you know? Just kind of see what those bitty parts are like. You have to... I think important when you're considering what role you want to take, whether what kind of character you want to take or what kind of GMing style you're going to have, you need to consider what your purpose is going to be in that role. What is the story you're trying to tell here? At least that's how I do it. I don't know if anybody else maybe listening does it the same way. But when I look at making a new character as a player, I think about what is the story I want to tell? And how do I want to get there? Because everything else is kind of just details. Like, what story is interesting me right now? My werewolf character. My husband runs a Werewolf the Apocalypse game. Old school World of Darkness. Woo woo. Okay. Anyway, my character Aster, he is, when I thought about what kind of character I wanted, you know, I have all these tribes available. I have all these abilities available. I have, you know, you have everything available to you. It can be a little overwhelming when you're starting to find what role you want to play. And I started thinking about it. And another piece of advice in figuring out your role and how your role works within a group is I always like all of us to discuss our characters together. Because then people can fill in gaps or they get ideas or stuff like that rather than, I mean, if you have to bring them together, you know, do it separately, bring them together, but then adjust, you know, I always like people to kind of talk through their characters as a group before. But the point is, when I thought about what story I wanted to play, what story I wanted to do, what kind of character I wanted to be, Aster is, I was really fascinated with the idea of an outcast, someone who has a heart of gold, an ability that you don't think that they would have given their personality, and they are outcasts because of it, and they become bitter because of it too. So Aster had parents who, and he's a Metis, which in the game means that his parents were in werewolf form when they had him, which is kind of taboo. And so he became a Metis, which is, it's always quite obvious. He's albino. So that's very obvious to anyone who sees him that he's a Metis. His, you know, because, you know, mating when you're wolves or mating when you're in human forms is fine. But waiting when you're in your huge Krenos big werewolf form is a no-no. And so, but that happened. So his parents left the tribe with him and he had a rough life because werewolves don't change until they like hit puberty in werewolf. So if you're human, if you're born Hamid, you're a human until you turn into a werewolf, or you're a wolf until you turn into a human. If you're a Krenos form, a big, huge, hulking werewolf form, you don't turn from that until you're a teenager. So there's nowhere to hide. You have to be hidden away.
Yeah.
And so for a long time, it was him and his parents. And his parents died. His parents took upon themselves that they are both very skilled in the spiritual aspect of Garou society. Searching in the spirit world and the Umbra and everything. And they taught him everything that he needed to know. And they went around the country as nomads, helping to solve these spiritual problems where they popped up in the spirit world. His parents were dealing with one of these things and they died.
Okay.
So he lost his parents. And he's outcast by werewolf society because of who his parents were and how he was born. And he's just very tired and he has no tolerance for anyone passive aggressively coming up to him, or no tolerance for anyone's shit, for lack of a better term, because of how rough of a childhood he had and losing his parents young and then being on his own. So I was very, the story I wanted to tell with him was coming from that place. Can he find connections? Can he find people who he can care about, right? Can he find a pack of his own, you know?
Nice.
And that's the story I wanted to tell with him. I wanted him to go from being on his own, being kind of this Constantine, he smoked hardcore too. And, you know, he smoked a lot, he swirled, but he was also this, like, spiritual person and would go through the spirit realm and everything. So it was very much kind of a Constantine kind of thing going on, you know. And going from that to actually having friends and people in his life and a pack of his own. And so I kind of discussed this with my husband. Because I always feel like that's kind of what's kind of what I want to know as a GM. Like, what kind of arc are you wanting to do? Where are you imagining them going? So that if I'm the GM, I can give them opportunities to do that.
Yeah.
And so my husband did. He ended up saving this little girl. And this little girl attached themselves to him. And how could he be bitter and how could he be mean in the face of this little six-year-old girl?
Yeah.
Calling him puppy and like wanting that him to protect her. He couldn't do that, you know? And it was this thing where everybody watching was just like, oh my God, you know? And he quit smoking because he didn't want to smoke around the kid. And that was hard.
Yep.
you know, and he was not a pleasant person to be around for a long time while he quit.
Yeah.
And he'll still complain and say, this is why I smoked. Like, if something is going wrong. Like, he'll just be like, this is why I smoked, y'all. You know, like, good God. And so I try to find that with each character that I have.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny because a lot when I took a writing course, my teacher had said that there was this interesting theme that I had in my writing where it was the characters or the main character was looking for something for somebody else, some kind of connection, some kind of missing piece. And I find that that's true of the role-playing characters that I choose to play as well. I pick people who might not know who they are or outcast or misfits or have obstacles to overcome and trying to find over the course of the story some way to become a whole human being, you know, to become. And if they have a disability or an obstacle, I don't mean like getting cured. I mean finding kind of an inner peace or finding a place that they can be who they are.
Yeah.
And whatnot. And so I encourage like everybody at the table to kind of figure out that role that they have. Like what role is my character going to play in all this? Who are they going to be? Are they the voice of reason? You know, are they the sarcastic cynic? You know, who are they? And where do I hope to get them at the end? How do they change? Because a story where characters don't change is really, there are some that work, but you have to be telling a very different kind of story that usually doesn't come up in role-playing games. Like Legally Blonde is a good example. If you've ever seen that movie. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't. I've heard a lot about it. I've worked in video stores, so I'm aware of a lot of movies I've never seen.
Well, the point is that the main character in that L, she doesn't change who she is. And the way that she grows is realizing that she was already enough as she was. So there is a bit of growth there, but it's different. Like, she doesn't change aspects of herself. What she changes is her attitude of self-worth and self-love.
Yeah, her acceptance, right? Of herself. Mm-hmm.
And not trying to be something for somebody else that people think, like not being in the box that people think she should be in, you know. I don't know. I've talked a long time about, yeah. I mean, how do you feel? Like, if you want to talk about roles, did you want to talk about anything in particular or add on to what I was saying? Or
I think adding on to that, just going with the whole GM player dynamic, because for me, and maybe it's something we'll use another episode to get into, there are different roles that players can take at the table, but yeah, for now let's just keep going with this whole GM versus player is a bad way of saying it, but GM and player dynamic.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about the way that you're, as you were talking about your character's motivation and everything that you like to build in, this idea of them having this personal journey of acceptance and everything. I don't know. I can't think of any of characters that I have portrayed as a GM or a player, actually, that have really had that kind of motivation in there. I think because I always go into these games being so action focused. And what I mean by that is not necessarily that it's always got to be action packed. It's always got to be a chase scene or something, but it's more of like what they do personifies the character versus their intentions going into something, their motivations or anything like that. And, you know, yeah, maybe that's one of the reasons why GMing, once again, kind of works, you know, more so for me, because that's something that I can do. I can really bullet point. Like, if I really want to demonstrate that somebody is corrupt or that somebody, you know, like, looks out for themselves first and has to learn how to be a part of a group, let's just say as an example, I would demonstrate that by, you know, like picking someone's pocket. The first time that character is seen, he's literally just like, you know, swiped a coin purse out of somebody. And then you could see it right then and there. Because then for me, it allows, you know, everyone else at the table to then kind of interpret it their own way. But as far as like going in with that kind of depth and layer and detail, I think some of the other thing too with it is that as a player, because I GM so much more, for me, it's almost kind of less like, I feel like it's more my job to make sure that the GM has something to work with. Because then that, there's two things that does. Rather than coming up with a very concrete kind of background and then giving that to the GM to then incorporate some of that in there, I like the idea of saying, of just basically leaving it kind of blank. I'm heading in a general direction of, I want a character who is down on his luck and he's in hard times and he's in a rough patch when he comes across these others and we begin this adventure. And we kind of get some general ballpark ideas, but then as far as, well, who is it that caused my character to go into this bad luck? You go ahead, GM. You come up with something and you give that to me, and then I'll just react to that based on what we've established in the narrative so far at that point. Because then that, once again, that allows me to create more at the table. I think it's more of like, the characters that I've enjoyed playing the most are the ones where I've been discovering things about them when the time comes. Like the character I mentioned before, Sergeant Marcus Crawford was his name. I remember that very vividly. I don't remember a lot of my characters, but I remember him very vividly. When I first made him, we were playing AD&D, so the second edition of D&D, and I had so many characters died that I was just like, you know what? Fuck it. I just want to play a fighter with 18 strength. I just want to have the best possible ability score for their predominant ability, which is strength, and then I'm just going to kick ass, take names, and I'll figure the rest out from there. I just want a character that's not going to die. Mm-hmm. And that's what I made. And then the GM said, okay, well, let's do a little something more. And that's when he came up with the, you know, you're actually plotting against them. You're a spy within the group. And your job is to report back and all this kind of. And as soon as they succeed, you are to then turn on them and make sure that they never leave again. Because we can't let the secret out that the king lost this medallion. That would be terrible. He might lose the throne. As we played and I had time to basically interact with these characters, you know, and acting like, you know, super macho tough guy, and then start to feel the personality of this character start to manifest, that to me, that's what, for me, what made it a very rewarding experience. The end result was, wow, that character that was just like, look, can I just have 18 strength? Done. You know, that character became the most fascinating, most complex character that I've ever played because that's just how it came about during play.
Yeah.
So whereas, I don't know, maybe I should just, the next time when I do go to play something, I should try and go into the say this, like, this is who I want to play rather than what I want to play. Maybe that's the best way of putting it. I always go in with what.
Oh, that's how I do it. Because I didn't pick, I never pick my game stuff. Like if I'm doing vampire, I don't pick my clan. If I'm playing werewolf, I don't pick my tribe. I try to start with a person, right? And then I try to figure out what would be the best for them, right? How would they turn out in case of mechanics? And, you know, I mean, you're talking about action and the motivation and everything. And personally, those two things go hand in hand, in my opinion. Actions are powerful. Making a sacrifice is powerful. Saving somebody is powerful. Doing something kind for somebody is powerful, or mean, or whatever. All of these actions that we take, killing somebody or punching somebody or trying to swindle somebody, anything that you want to do, they're powerful actions, but they become more powerful when they have a motivation behind them that we know and everybody at the table knows. Like if my character Aster that I mentioned before had run into this little girl and protected her and saved her, and we didn't know anything about him, it wouldn't be as powerful as everybody at my table knowing that he was an outcast and has a hard time caring about people and had a very prickly exterior, and watch him melt at this little girl. It becomes so much more. You know, the action on its own is powerful. Protecting a child is powerful. But knowing that it is not in his personality at that point, it's not his instinct. Or it is, and it's so buried, and this is so powerful that it's coming out against all of the protections that he's put against himself, against being hurt. It makes it more powerful. To use another example, Tony Stark, right? MCU, right? Robert Downey Jr. His relationship with Peter Parker is so much more powerful because we know how Tony was, right? And to watch him kind of become a mentor and care about this teenager is so much more powerful because we have watched that journey and saw him get into that place, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I think it's something I'm definitely going to have to, when I do go to play, because it is one of the things that I do want to do. I want to start playing in other people's games. But I think at the same time, too, I want to do that as something where it's like, well, I want to do it in a different genre, I guess, so to speak. Because, like, it's action-packed games and everything are all fine and good, you know, where it's a lot of, you know, violence, basically. Games with violence in any way, shape, or form, which is the majority of media we all seem to consume. But I think when I play, I want to do something where I have more ability to get more in-depth with it. But I think it also depends on who it is that I'm playing with. And that's one of those other things. I know that the people I play with in general are the more action type. You know, like the way that I've been playing and GMing fits well with these particular people. There's nobody that I think of who I'm currently playing with who I could go into this very extended monologue, or I can get, like, you know, really in depth with, you know, like their feelings or emotions or some kind of thing like that.
You need to play with me then.
You need to play with me then. Well, and now that I have online access, that's kind of where I'm thinking. It's kind of like, you know, I have this ability to not only have a little bit more gaming without a 2-hour commute, I get to kind of pick the people that I can play with, and I'm not limited by geography in that sense. Unless someone's on the opposite side of the world and I'd have to play at 3 a.m. But, you know, if I'm that desperate.
Yeah.
But yeah, like that, and that's one of the things I have been thinking about. It's just like, you know, like I've got my home groups and these are things we do and I really enjoy doing it. But at the same time too, I would like to, if I'm gonna play, I really want to stretch my muscles. And at, you know, like after having this conversation, it's just like, yeah, I want to start trying to play somebody who has an idea of who they are and what they went through before we even start the first scene, which I never do with anything else. I'm very, like I said, I really like the raw experience of, I don't know what this is going to be going in. Let's just play it and see how it goes. And I'm going to react to the room.
I don't think, you know, I find, and I understand you saying, you know, like just kind of seeing where it goes. But I also find that playing the way I do, I am constantly surprised. I am constantly surprised. But it's, again, having that solid base of the character I built and to let them surprise me sometimes because I built them that way. Mm. And things always happen that are surprising to me in a game, you know, that no matter what I've done with the character or an NPC, I find that almost every game is see where it goes. You know what I mean? Like, I have a good intention, whether I'm a player or whether I'm a GM. Like, you know as well as I do, being a GM, that you're like, yes, this is the big story I'm going to tell, you know? Like, this evil corporation is trying to take over this apartment complex so they can mow it down and build a mall and blah, 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 blah. And that's your plan, right? But it's probably not going to happen that way. You know, it's probably not going to be like that, like you imagine. And so I find there is still some surprise for me and still some seeing where it goes. Maybe not as much in terms of my character, but even then they still surprise me. Like the character I mentioned has surprised me constantly with some of the stuff that he does, just because I built him in my mind. And when you do that, whether you're writing on a page or you're playing a character or you're an actress or actor on stage, when you have built that, this is what writers talk about when they say the characters have a mind of their own, right? Because you've built them and their experiences. And so what they're going to do just becomes logic, right? Even if you didn't realize it until that moment, you know, until Aster was confronted with this little girl who needed his protection, I had no idea how he was going to react to it, right? Until this opportunity was presented to him in the middle of a fight, in the middle of a huge action-packed thing, Nathan turns to me and he goes, okay, Aster, you turn and you see this little girl and there is one of these black spiral dancers coming after her, right? And I had no idea how he was going to react to that until Nathan required that I think about that. And then it was just obvious. Yeah. Of course he's going to protect this child. He has a heart. He's just protected it really well, right? And so then it just becomes obvious. The logical conclusion, obviously that's what he's going to do. And so it surprises you because you get asked and you just have to think about what you've built already. And you know that's how they're going to react, you know? And so it can still surprise you and all of that.
Yeah, that's true. I'm thinking about it. There's been a couple of times where I've LARPed, like only two times, actually. And one of them was for a LARP of my own creation. Go figure. but in both those cases, I was a player with one character. But that was, I could use all the tools of the trade. Like basically in that case, then I was acting because I'm actually moving around in a physical space. I am observing how other people move about in that same space and, you know, and picking up on the visual cues of the scene and what's located where and everything else like this. And in that particular case, I was very able to get into character. And like, so the first LARP I did was Emily Kerr Boss's Ericom Lawn, which is from her romance trilogy collection of games. And that's basically where you're telling the story of King Arthur and Excalibur, and you're doing it in individual scenes. And I got to play King Arthur.
Oh, nice. And,
you know, knowing what to expect of King Arthur. And also, too, I was going off of like the 1981 movie Excalibur as my basis for King Arthur. And it was one of those things where it was very easy for me to keep up because I think there was just a lot. It was a more stimulating environment in the sense of that you're actually physically portraying the character rather than sitting in a chair and describing what your character is doing. Now you got to get up and you actually got to do this stuff. It was the same thing when we did I made a poker LARP. It's a LARP that you play. And LARP, let's clarify for anyone who doesn't know, is a live action role playing game where basically you're generally not sitting at a table looking at your sheet rolling dice. You are portraying a character in a physical space on a stage of some kind or another. And in this one, we were playing poker, but as different characters, one of us was blackmailing the other three and drama unfolds. And when that was happening, I was able to very much stay in character, had a basis of who this character was, and they were basically a washed up drummer from a punk rock band in the 80s, from a British punk rock band from the 80s, who threw his career away on cocaine, got kicked out of the band, and now he's basically a shell of himself. And I was able to, that's what I went going in, yeah, and was able to stick with that, but then also too found interesting things about the character as it progressed because you're feeding off of what other people give. It's a yes and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
exactly.
I don't know, maybe that's what it is. Maybe I need to LARP more. That's the answer.
Maybe, and in terms of roles, to kind of finish up a bit, let's talk about the Game Master. So, Game Master, as there are some books out there, I can't remember which one, but several of them have done this, where it says, the Game Master, game moderator, storyteller, whatever you are in that particular game, is also a player. You know, The person running the game is not more important than the players. They just have a very different role. They have a different role that is often more work. But in terms of importance, they aren't. You know what I mean? And I always view my job, my role, as someone running the game. And I have told this to my players. And I've run a 7C game, which anybody can watch, by the way, on Rook and Rass. We finished 2 seasons of it. It's very dramatic. And I tell them, and I tell my group at home, I am playing the antagonists, right? I'm playing the obstacles in your way. But I am not in your way. I want to help you.
Yeah.
I want to help you. My job is to support you in whatever story you want to tell. Like, you know, you tell me, you know, like in the vampire game that I ran, I have a character who, his sire betrayed him in vampire, classic vampire, World of Darkness. His sire betrayed him and left him in torpor for a long, long time. And that was the story he wanted to tell. He wanted to tell his story of his character trying to get revenge on his sire for that. And what he discovered along the way was that there were a lot of things out there. And maybe he wasn't. Maybe there were other things more important and stuff, which I don't know if that's what he was going for or not. But my job was to facilitate that, right? My job was to bring these things up in NPC conversation with him. My job was to give him interactions with his sire when he was finally able to contact him. My job was to be able to give him soundboards so he could talk about what happened to him and happened to his character. And that's my job, right? That's my job. And I take that very, very seriously. Not to use a kink phrase, but I always like to talk to myself that my style of GMing is basically I'm a service top, which means I will give you everything you want. I will hurt you in all the ways you want me to hurt you. I will make you cry. I will make you pissed off if you want me to, but you have to tell me how to do that. You have to tell me how you want that to happen. And I will do it.
Yeah.
And that's how I see it. I am here. You tell me what you want. Do you want sad drama? Do you want angst? Do you want heartbreak? Do you want adrenaline? Do you want what kind of things do you want to feel with this character? And then my job is to give that to you in terms of the antagonists and allies and the situations that you find themselves in to facilitate those feelings and that growth and that emotion. And if you do it right, you get these scenes that stick with you just as much as any movie or any book. You know what I mean? They become powerful when the role of the GM and the person running the game meets with the players a need to want to have for their character. When those come together and support each other, you have these scenes that are so powerful. And I mean, everyone just kind of sits there in silence after and just kind of goes, whoa, right? Like, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's tough. That's a lot, you know? I've had moments like that. My husband in a 7C game, his character waited out knowing he wasn't going to come back and sacrificed himself, and he discussed it with the GM. And by the time it was all over and his compatriots were bringing his body back on their shoulders from the battlefield and he was dying and this whole castle started singing, because he was basically in 7C, they have the Highland Marches, which is basically Scotland. And basically as he's being borne back to the castle by his compatriots, the other characters, and were bringing his body back, and he's still not quite there, but he's mostly gone. And we are put him up on our shoulders, and we're bringing him back to the castle. The castle sees this, and they start singing. I'll take the high road, and you'll take the low road. Talking about death, right? And it was just this mournful, yeah. And we all started singing at the table. And we're all in tears, you know, and you know, because his body's being born back, and we're all singing this song, and everyone's giving him honor for what he did, his character did. And hell, if my characters go out, make it like that for the player. You know what I mean? Make it something worth giving up that character for, you know? And that's what I feel like the roles work with each other, and the other players are supposed to support that as well. Everybody is supporting each other in what story we want to play. And really, when you're talking about any kind of role, whether it's taking notes or being the GM and doing NPCs or any of that stuff, thinking about what your place is at the table, not only as the character, what's my character's role, sarcastic or the knowledgeable one or what have you, but what's my role as a player? And how can I support both the GM and the other players in doing what they're wanting to do? And that means stepping aside on certain occasions while a character has the spotlight. That means asking them leading questions so you get to that other character's backstory. It's all things that you can do. If you really have to think, come to terms with what is your role, what is your purpose for being there? And for me, that's what it is. I am supporting telling whatever story everybody else at the table wants to tell, whether I'm a player and I'm supporting the GM and the other players, or whether I'm the running the game and I'm supporting the other players, right? And I've done awful things as the GM, I can tell you. Like I have done absolutely atrocious things. I have turned around and said the meanest things. I have done the most awful things because they wanted me to, right? Because they wanted somebody like that so that they could push against it and their character would grow. And so I provide that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. That was a long tangent.
You're challenging them.
I love
them.
Stories.
it's really getting me thinking, you know, because of other things we've talked about on this show. One of the main similarities between role-playing games and witchcraft, as I'm learning, is the energy that you put in and the energy that you get out. And I think maybe that's the way that I need to maybe start looking at this, is that if I'm playing in a game, I am not trying to get the same energy that I am when I GM. You know, like, even in a game that ends up being kind of so-so, I know the energy that I'm going to get out of it no matter what. It's very rare for me to walk away from anything I've GM'd, which is partial bragging. I mean, and there's a reason for that. I'm pretty good. But I know, like, I know what I'm going to get out of it, and so I know what I need to put in to get that result, because I am a part of this as well. If I half-ass my role as the GM, you know, then I can't expect to get that kind of energy boost that I want by being the GM. And maybe that's the thing I need to start taking a look at, it is, you know, what is it that I want to get as a player with a particular character? And so what do I have to put in order to get that? And that actually sounds like something that we could talk about. That sounds like an other episode unto itself. And I think that's, let's add
that
to the
queue. We always do that, though.
We do, don't we?
Like, it's like, yeah, there's something else.
Yeah, we cross one item off the topic list and then three more get added on.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I love it so much, regardless. And it even works, as you were saying, in witchcraft, because if you're in a coven and you're doing magic together in a circle, it's the same thing. What is my role here? My role is to support my other witches in creating this magic and putting in this energy, and I'm going to add my own unique energy to it. And what energy am I bringing to this work and this ritual or this celebration and everything like that? It's the same sort of thing in a lot of ways. And I'm just all about everybody working towards the same goal. And I always tell my players, as I said earlier, I am not against you. This is how I run my games. I am here to support you. You need to talk to me and tell me what you want. And I promise you, I will do my best to make that happen. If you're nervous about something that's coming up, ask me. Like, part of that is I feel like GMs are often too coy about what's in their head and on their sheets and on their paper. You know what I mean? Not that I don't have secrets from my players, because obviously. But there are some things that I don't mind letting them in on my process, or asking them. You know what I mean? Asking them, what are you hoping to get out of this interaction? Or if I see that there's something really bothering them, I will say to them, what can I do to comfort you? What can I do to put you at ease? If I let you in on something that I'm planning, would that help you feel more comfortable? Right?
Yeah.
To know that this is not a thing, and your player comes to you and says, look, I'm really worried. I know you've been hinting that my sister had something really awful happen to her, and I'm just really afraid it's something that's on my trigger list.
Yeah.
And I am more than willing to say, it is this. And to make you feel more comfortable, it is this. And I find that they're often more than willing to step up to that task of then working with you. Bring your player in on the story that you're trying to tell with them as much as possible. Yes, you want to surprise. Yes, you want to have twists. Yes, you want to have all of that. But let them in. You know what I mean? Let them in and say, hey, when I bring in this NPC, I'm kind of hoping that this is what it will do for you. Because if they're in on it, they can support you in that instead of trying to push against it, right? Or if they're saying, no, I don't want that, you can adjust it together. So you both know that when they meet this NPC, that's what's happening. You know, like the sire that I talked about with my vampire game, I sat down and talked to him and I was like the player and I said, what are you wanting out of this relationship? What was this relationship like? What do you want these encounters to feel like? You know? And he told me. And so I did my best to give him that. And he knew I was trying to give him that. So when we got together and I was playing his sire and he was playing his character, we kind of both knew what we were going after. It's just like having a scene partner on stage. You both know what you are going after. You both know that you're trying to hit that goal for that scene. And so that's what I try to do at the table, you know?
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. I source the table. Yeah, I like to get my players involved in the place where their characters are, particularly too in the beginning when it's like, okay, so we're on your home turf, you know. So like in Ironbound with my Ottawa group, when we first started doing that, I like to encourage everyone to put their own touches on the village of Bristlewood, and have them, like, I have a couple of core characters that are written down as, you know, like the person who runs the tavern is named Ilsa. That's simply because I know there's something in the tavern, so I need somebody working there ready to go in the event of. But when it came down to, it's just like, oh, well, let's see if we can go and trade for some supplies. It's like, oh, okay. What kind of relationship would you have with it? Is this somebody that you've done a regular business with? And mm-hmm. What kind of shop is this? Is it something that exists like in a barn at the back of someone's farm? Is this like something that exists that's right next to, you know, like the temple? And giving them that confidence of knowing that they can contribute to those elements, I have found then... It keeps it as a very, we're all feeding off of each other, and that when it comes to plot point ideas, I do find that my players feel more comfortable saying it's like, you know what? What I'm worried about is that we're starting to go a little kind of off the rails here. You know, like, what does everyone think if we were to do something to kind of, you know, like, get us back on track for this? We're focusing too much on truffle hunting. Which is what my group has currently been doing. Because I think I've mentioned you personally, but they're planning on using truffles to sway the apothecary to their side. They're just like, no one can refuse truffles. I'm like, okay, well, let's give it a shot.
Let's try it.
They were able to get involved. Yeah, exactly. They were able to get involved and say, it's like, you know what? This part's fun, but let's not forget one of the things that we want to do. And then I find players... when they know that they get to contribute to details, big and small, then I find you get more of a writer's table atmosphere, which is the stuff that I've really been enjoying.
When
I first started role-playing, when I first started role-playing, it was very much, I am the GM. It is my job to control the world and to determine if what they're trying to do to my world is acceptable. You know, that I was basically judge, jury, and executioner of the game. And now for me, it's way more writer's table. It even manifests in the games that I make. Like, you know, even with the Ironbound playtest, there's a section in there that says the GM is also a player. They're just playing like a modified version of the game, but it's still, they're playing something. They need something to do. They need to be able to contribute and all this other kind of stuff. And even too, with the different approaches that you can then choose so that you're making an open statement. Like in my game, I'm a water player. And what that means is that it's very cooperative. And so as a water guide, as the term we use in Ironbound, my job is to support the other players and to facilitate what it is that they want to do. If I decided that I was going to be an earth guide, then it would be like, no, my job is to try and kind of block you in certain ways and to make things difficult and to show that this world is harsh. You know, I'm going to force you to get into some of the realities of war. Be prepared for me to kind of drop bombshells on you. If I was a fire player, it'd just be like, I'm going to stat the hell out of this NPC. I'm going to add more hit points to this machine. I want to see your characters bleed. I want to see them burn. I want to see them sweat. Kind of thing like that. Having that approach out in the open, and it's even on my card, like we all have the little index card, so I can see everyone's character's name, their familiar's name, and you know, and what element they use, and then also to what approach that all of us have when we play, so that they know I'm here to help, or I'm here to kick your ass, and it's established right from the very beginning. And that level of communication, so there's a whole bunch of different ways of doing it. But yeah, this is the one that I find works for me, is giving them that sense of investment in what we're doing. That this version of Nevala, this version of a Pandora Academy, this version of Faerun only exist here at this table. It's like a, since multiverses are so cool now, we're in a multiverse. This is our particular world. And somewhere else out there is another GM who has, you know, taken Faerun and moved it to the 31st century, you know, and then there's another GM who has killed Elminster, you know, all this other kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Well, any last bit? Because we have true to form gone over.
Yes, we have. That's how we do it. If we didn't call this podcast Cup Instead, we'd be calling it Going Long.
Going Long.
Yeah, I think we should definitely, let's do a part two on this one and get more into player roles at the table, because the GM is just one of the players. And there, I think there's still, even today, a lot of misconceptions about being the player doesn't just mean, oh, I do this and I only do this. You know, that there is different ways that you can help facilitate the game at the table. So how about we talk about that for next time? And then we'll ramble on for an hour and 16 minutes there.
Yeah, sure. Sounds good. Sounds good to me.
Done. It's a date.
All right. So I hope you all enjoyed this. Definitely check out the Discord, Facebook, and the Facebook, which will be linked below the episode, and let us know. I mean, how do you feel? How do you feel? What are the roles of the player and the person running the game on your table? What is your perspective or philosophy on that? Let us know. Talk to us about it. And until next time, we wish you a little magic in your gaming and a little gaming in your magic.
The Covenstead podcast was created and produced by Daniel Delisle and Todd Grapper. Theme music written and composed by John Thompson from the Rook and Rask channel on Twitch. Definitely check them out. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.